Aren't you glad you're a Christian? Well, I want to thank Logan and the others who made the Man Camp and the Chicks and Chocolate a success. The teens seem to really enjoy those things, so we appreciate that. At the beginning of springtime each year, the Jews celebrate the Feast of Purim. My accent's probably a little bit off there. But it means the casting of lots. And what it is it commemorates the time when the lot was cast against the Jews, and Esther stood up and she saved her people. Well, they still observe it today. And from what I understand, during the celebrations, the story of Esther is read twice at two different times. And whenever the bad guy's name is read, well, they make a lot of noise and they use these things called ratchets or graggers, which they spin around whenever the bad guy's name is pronounced out loud. All right. Like many couples, my wife and I enjoy watching movies together. But we wouldn't always choose the same ones, because I think her choice would probably be something like a drama or a romantic comedy, whereas I would probably choose an action adventure or a thriller. But every now and then, we come across a movie that's got everything, and we're both happy. Well, I think the Book of Esther has one of those storylines. See, Esther is not just this real-life rags-to-riches Cinderella story. Well, it almost reads like a modern suspense novel with a plot full of intrigue and irony and twists. And the thing is, though, unlike works of fiction, Esther is set in history with specific dates. And it's presented as real history and genuine history. Well, a lot of people say that the theme of Esther is the providence of God, which is very interesting because God is not mentioned. We got a book of the Bible here without a reference to God. Now, we do find fasting and sackcloth and lamentations, but it almost seems as if the author made just considerable effort to keep any mention of God, prayer, or other religious matters out of the text. And some people think, well, maybe it was a rhetorical device. Others think that it was written to be kept in the Persian records. It was to be put in there. Or maybe it was later copied from Persian records. And, you know, that kind of talk, it wouldn't have been allowed. And we're also not told who the author is. Now, some people suggest Ezra or Nehemiah or Mordecai, but we don't know. It doesn't really matter. I mean, God made sure that it got in his book, and so it's important no matter how it came about. Now, something else is that there are no miracles in the Book of Esther. See, it's more like what we're used to being in the non-miraculous age. I mean, no one today has been given the ability to part the waters or to raise the dead. And you're not going to find a burning bush that's going to talk to you, and God's not going to write in the sky, you know, "Ty, get back to work," or "I want you to do this." And so it's more like what we're used to today. We have God's word, and we have His providence, Romans 8:28. And so the Book of Esther reminds us that we don't need to see God to know that He is not far from each one of us, as Paul said in Acts 17:27. See, the entire book shows us that God's guiding hand was surely working behind the scenes in one way or another. And I believe it is today. So I want you to see the providence of God, but I also want you to see the power of one. You see, in this world of about 7 billion people, it is very easy to feel insignificant. You know, that you couldn't make a dent. How can I make a difference? I'm just one person. But there is power in one. You think about all the military battles that have turned because of the influence of one heroic person. Think of all the individual scientists and inventors and those who were explorers and so forth who changed the history of the world. And so there is power in one. So what's it going to take for us here today to make a difference? Well, the answer is God, of course. So we've got to figure out whom are the kind of people that God uses. So that brings us to Esther. Now, if you haven't already, let's open our Bibles. Let's take a look at this great book. One of the two books in the Bible named after a woman. Chapter 1. Vashti's refusal. Verses 1 and 2. Now it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel in Susa. Now Ahasuerus, he's the king of the Medo-Persian Empire, which means at this time, he is the most powerful man on earth. Now, just to get you up to date, after Cyrus beat the Babylonians, and the Medo-Persian Empire became the world power, well, he told the Jews that they could go home from their exile. They could just go home and do their thing. But many of them decided to stay. Only about, you know, Ezra chapter 2, we see only about 50,000 of them actually went home. And so many of them, well, they had made a home there for whatever reasons. You know, they preferred the comforts of the land. Maybe they had attained positions of importance or wealth. Who knows? So that's where we're at here. See, Ahasuerus is a few kings down from Cyrus. Well, the time frame is in between the events recorded in Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7. It's about 40 years in between the finishing of the temple and the finishing of the walls in Jerusalem. Well, our story is based in Susa, the capital. Now, Susa was the winter residence of the Persian kings, about 150 miles north of the Persian Gulf, present-day Iran. So we're introduced to this guy, Ahasuerus. Now, if you got an NIV, you see that it uses his Greek name, Xerxes. Now, some people who read the book of Esther, they say, okay, this can't be real. All right, nobody would do the things that this guy did. But the thing is, we learned some about him from Herodotus, the ancient Greek historian. And this king, man, he seems to have been a real nut. Just for example, there was this time when he had this bridge built across the Hellespont Strait. Well, sure enough, a storm came and destroyed this bridge. He was so angry that he had the bridge builders beheaded, and he ordered that the sea be scourged. Now, can you imagine Ahasuerus' servants out there whipping the sea? All right? And so, I mean, here's an artist's depiction of it. But that's not the only story. There are many other stories that portray him just as dangerously impulsive and unorthodox. So keep in mind that, yes, this guy would do these things. In fact, it fits his character quite well. Verses 3 and 4. In the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. You notice that feasting is very important in this book. There's actually 10 of them mentioned in Esther, and most of the main events happen around them. All right, we learn from Herodotus that during this time, he's getting ready for his naval invasion of Greece. And so they're working out the preparations for that, this invasion, during the six-month conference here. And of course, he's showing off, you know. I mean, he's trying to show that he really is powerful enough to beat the Greeks. Well, at the end of these 180 days, we read here that he threw a feast for all the people in Susa to come to. See, the men, they were to hang out with the king in the palace gardens, and the women were to hang out with the queen in the palace itself. Well, verse 8, we see he made this law for the occasion, that everyone is to drink as much as they want to. And of course, we're not talking about iced tea here. So we find in verse 10 that on the seventh day of this feasting, it says that the king was merry with wine, and I'm pretty sure that means that he was somewhat inebriated. Now, I don't know if he was full-on hammered, sloshed, plastered, or as they say in Australia, off his face, but he was certainly under the influence. Now, he commanded his eunuchs to bring Queen Vashti so she could, well, display herself. Now, Vashti is Persian for beautiful, and she fit her name well. And so she had a choice. She could, well, disobey the king, which was illegal, or lose her honor as she displayed herself in front of all these drunken men of Susa. Well, she chose the act of moral courage and honor. Verse 12. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. Now, Herodotus wrote this, okay, of the Persians. They are very fond of wine and drink it in large quantities. It is also their general practice to deliberate upon affairs of weight when they are drunk. Sometimes, however, they are sober at their first deliberation, but in this case, they always reconsider the matter under the influence of wine. Now, I really don't think I need to spend much time here talking about the dangers of alcohol. I mean, you know, how many of the problems of the world could be traced back to the doorway of alcohol abuse? I mean, there are good reasons why the Bible calls drunkenness a sin. But to the king's credit, he didn't say, off with her head or something like that. He got together his wise men, and the question as asked here in verse 15, according to the law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? In verses 16 and 17, in the presence of the king and the princes, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. And so he said, this is going to cause a national crisis. I mean, the men are going to be sitting in their easy chairs watching football and saying, woman, get me a beer. And she's going to respond, get it yourself. Queen Vashti wouldn't do it. And so they agreed this is going to cause a real problem. And so they decide to send out this edict. And it is to be heard throughout all the kingdom. It says Vashti can no longer be queen. She can no longer come in the king's presence. And that men are to be the heads of the household. Throwing in there for good measure that foreign wives are to learn the language of their husbands and not the other way around. So, something else to keep in mind. We learn here in verse 19 that the laws of Persia and Media could not be repealed once they were made. Now, that's something we learn in the book of Daniel as well. All right, chapter 2, Esther's coronation. All right, chapter 2, we find out from verse 16 that this is a few years later. So what in the world has happened in between chapter 1 and chapter 2? Well, again, Herodotus helps us out. This was during his Grecian invasion, his Grecian campaign when he invaded Greece. And, well, didn't turn out so good. As Wilbur Field said, he was stopped at Thermopylae, defeated at the naval battle of Salamis, and nearly annihilated at Plataea. He returned to Persia, and in the seventh year, he sought consolation with his harem, according to Herodotus. And so he pretty much fled with his tail tucked between his legs, coming home to lick his wounds. Well, verse 1, we see that, well, he remembered Queen Vashti, and no longer angry about that incident in chapter 1. And it sounds like he was kind of sad about it. Be very careful about rash, impulsive, and of course, inebriated decisions that you may regret later. Okay, verses 2 through 4. Then the king's attendants who served him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, to the harem, into the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women. And let their cosmetics be given them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti. And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Now, there is a reason why the man in charge of the king's harem is a eunuch, but we're not going to talk about that. Well, of course, this idea pleased the king. And so we've got the first national beauty contest recorded in history. All right, we're now introduced to Mordecai. And we learn in verses 5 and 6 that his great-grandfather, quote, had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, which, of course, we read about in the end of 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. And although Mordecai had been given this Babylonian name, see, it's after the pagan god Marduk, we can see that his love was actually for God's people, for the Jews, his fellow Jews. Well, we learn in verse 7 that Mordecai's uncle and aunt had died, leaving Esther, his young cousin. And so he went ahead and adopted her, he went ahead and raised her, And the name Esther, it comes from the Persian word for star. And, well, she certainly becomes that in our story. Well, we also learn that she was beautiful. And so verse 8 says, "It came about when the command and decree of the king were heard, and many young ladies were gathered to Susa, the capital, into the custody of Haggai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the custody of Haggai, who was in charge of the women." Now, that is a pretty bum deal. See, I really don't see how that's much less than kidnap and rape, you know, what the kings would do like this from time to time. The Jewish historian Josephus, he tells us that tradition says that 400 women were taken at this time. Now, that may or may not be an exaggeration, but it's still pretty amazing. Well, Haggai, he thought Esther was pretty special. And so he thought she was exceptional. He made sure that she got the special cosmetics and food, the best maids, the best place in the harem. In verses 10 and 11, it says that Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. Every day, Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. And so, you know, he's still trying to be the father figure. He's still trying to protect her the best that he can, take care of her. And keeping her background, keeping that, you know, quiet, that secret, is probably done to protect her as well. I suspect the Jews were still not looked on very highly, maybe still with some disfavor. All right, let's drop down to verse 15. "Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go in to the king, she did not request anything except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her." This is really good advice. Bloom where you are planted. You know, you may find yourself in a place or a position that, well, it's not your first choice, but you can still choose how to act, how to respond to it. As the saying goes, when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. Now, Esther did, and I think so can we. Well, something else. Maybe it's just me, but it seems that respect for parents and elders today is kind of gone by the wayside. It's found less and less in today's young people. But as we see here, Esther, you know, she listened to and respected both Mordecai and Haggai, and it paid off. So, what did the king think of her? Let's read verses 17 and 18. "The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a royal banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty." You see, this Jewish orphan girl has now found herself the queen of an empire comprised of more than half of the known world at that time. And it's very interesting how God's people kept on ending up in situations like that. You remember first Joseph in Egypt, and then Daniel in Babylon, and now Esther. Very interesting. Now, it is often the case that more wealth and power that a person falls into, or the higher they climb up the social ladder, it's much easier to become very self-centered, to think more about yourself. Very difficult to think more about the needs of others. They really go to your head. That's not what happened here with Esther, thankfully. She didn't fall into that. She didn't become, you know, Queenzilla or something like that. Well, we then come to a very important part of the story here, verses 21 through 23. This is going to be very significant later. "In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther. And Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now, when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence." Bigthan and Teresh, man, those guys just sound like thugs. But you notice that she could have taken credit for it, but she didn't. She informed the king in Mordecai's name, and so integrity. Now, that's another important character that we find in Esther. hanged on the gallows. It's literally hanged on a tree in the original. You may have a text note to that effect. Some scholars think that this could be speaking of being impaled on a pole or crucified, but it could also be speaking of being hanged, you know, as we normally think of it. So we come now to chapter 3, Haman's rage. This is where we are introduced to the bad guy, Haman. This is the guy, whenever his name is read during Purim, he gets the noisemakers. So he's coming to this position where he's second in command to the king. And the king has ordered that everyone has got to bow down to Haman. Now, Haman is an egomaniac. I mean, this guy, all right, he's extremely egotistical, and so he loved it, to be sure. Well, it says in verse 2, "But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage." Well, we can see Jews bowing down to kings from time to time in the Old Testament. So, why not bow down to Haman? Well, according to Herodotus, when the Persians bowed before their king, they paid homage as to a god. And so maybe Haman had claimed, I don't know, some kind of divine privileges or something like that, some divine honors. But Mordecai, he stood up for what he believed was right, even though he knew that it could get him in trouble. You see, today, there are a lot of things in our culture that people feel the pressure to bow down to, don't they? Well, some of the king's servants, they asked Mordecai why he didn't bow down to Haman. And like good little gossips, they took the information to Haman. They told him that Mordecai, well, he wouldn't bow down to him, and it was because he was a Jew. Now, verses 5 and 6. "When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus." See, he is willing to wipe out an entire race because one man in a multitude wouldn't bow down to him. It's amazing. And as you can see, narcissism, as well as anti-Semitism, those are not modern-day phenomena. You know, it's not a modern phenomenon. Well, Haman, he had them cast lots before him to decide when the Jews should be destroyed, the best day to do it. And that's where the name Purim comes in, the casting of lots. It's just a way to decide something, kind of like flipping a coin or pulling straws or throwing dice. Well, the lot fell about a year from that time. So, why did he decide with lots? I don't know, maybe the guy was superstitious, or maybe he wanted to show the Jews, who believed that their fate was decided by God, that no, actually their fate was decided by blind chance. Well, verses 8 and 9, it says, "Haman said to King Ahasuerus, 'There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws, so it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasury.' So he told them, 'Look, there are these people. Man, they stubbornly observe their own laws and customs, okay, and contrary to your laws." And of course, he tried to bribe him with 10,000 talents of silver. And from what I read, a talent was somewhere between 60 and 80 pounds. And so this is a significant amount of money. The king, though, the guy's so uninterested, all right, he didn't even inquire who the people were or what they had done. I mean, he simply gave him his signet ring, and he said, "You know what, you keep the money. Verse 11, do what you want with the people." And so here we've got a government-sponsored genocide. The king, he's signing the death warrant of his queen without even knowing it. Don't sign something you haven't read. Just some good practical advice. Verse 13, "And letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder." All right, chapter 4, Mordecai's plea. Let's read verses 1 through 3. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city and wailed loudly and bitterly. He went as far as the king's gate, for no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. In each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. Now, sackcloth, of course, very coarse, very uncomfortable material, often worn in times of repentance or mourning. Well, Esther, she found out about Mordecai, and so she sends him some clothes, you know, so he'd change, but no, he didn't accept them. And we get this really interesting dialogue between Esther and Mordecai through Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs. And Mordecai, he went ahead and gave her a copy of the edict, and he said that she was in the position to help here. I mean, she must go to the king to plead with him for her people. Well, we find Esther's reply in verse 11. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court, who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. You see, her life would be in great danger if she did this. Now, on top of that, she's kind of wondering about her relationship here with the king. Because you see, he hadn't summoned her in 30 days. And keep in mind, they're no longer newlyweds. Okay, it's been about 5 years since she became queen, according to chapter 3, verse 7. Verse 13. Then Mordecai told him to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews." You see, the decree couldn't be broken, and she just so happened to be a Jew. See, her life was already in danger. Verse 14. "For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this." You see, Mordecai had read his Bible. He knew about the seed promise to Abraham. See, whenever the Israelites were in danger of annihilation, and you know, it seems that Satan was trying to destroy the seed line, well, God would intervene. You see, God had promised that the Messiah was going to come from them. Nothing is going to stop that. Well, as he said here, God will do what he has promised, whether we drop the ball or not. But how sad to not be a part of that. You know, how tragic to not fulfill our potential. And then, of course, possibly you have to bear the consequences of not obeying God. Now, something else. Like Mordecai, I think we need to be very careful when trying to interpret the providence of God. He said, "And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this." I mean, even the Apostle Paul in Philemon 1:15, he said, "For perhaps he was for this reason parted from you for a while, that you should have him back forever." He said perhaps that thing with Onesimus was God's providence. I just need to be careful when saying that something is or is not God's will. I mean, beyond what's been revealed in the scriptures, we can't be dogmatic. All right, verse 15 and 16a. Then Esther told him to reply to Mordecai, "Go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way." Now, although it's not mentioned here, prayer was obviously involved as well. I mean, you know, it wasn't done to lose weight. And we can see, you know, I think we can see here that she's a good example to her maidens, who, well, as far as we know, that they weren't Hebrews. Verses 16b through 17. "And thus I will go to the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded. See, if a guard drives a sword through my body, I die doing what is right. And if you're a child of God, what is that really, death? You know, as it's been said, it's just being transferred to the home office. In 2 Corinthians 5:8, Paul put it like this, "We are of good courage, I say, and prefer rather to be absent from the body and to be at home with the Lord." Now, no doubt, that's a lot easier to say from a pulpit than it is when you're actually faced with it. If I perish, I perish. Could you have done that? Will you do that? Now, it may not be if I perish, I perish. It may be if I'm fired, I'm fired. Or if I'm unfriended, I'm unfriended. You see, will you and I do what is right no matter what? Will we worry about our own skin and whatever everyone else thinks about us over what God thinks? I mean, what's it going to be for you and me? Peace and popularity or preaching? You know, tiptoe and tolerance or truth? As Joshua put it, you're going to have to choose whom you're going to serve. You know, many people would have concluded, man, let someone else save the Jews. I don't want to risk my life. But not Esther. I mean, she decided that she was going to do it no matter what. So what happened? Well, you're going to have to come back next week and find out. I just want to leave you with this. What's the difference between a hero and the rest? Well, as it's been said, a hero takes action while the rest stand watching in horror. If I perish, I perish. As is our custom, we'd like to give you the invitation. If there are any spiritual needs this morning, if you'd like the prayers of the congregation, or if you need to be baptized into Christ, if there's anything you need to make right or make known, you can come forward now as we stand and sing, and one of the elders will talk with you.